From Luminary and Built It Productions, it's Wisdom from the Top. Stories of crisis, failure, turnaround, and triumph from some of the greatest leaders in the world. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, Jim Perdue, chairman, spokesman, and former CEO of Perdue Farms.
We get 3,000 to 4,000 contacts a month from consumers. Most of them complaints, and that's how we learn where we have problems. And I love that. And we actually get on the call and replay the recording of how we screwed up their dinner. And then the plants are on there, and that plant manager has to answer the question about how they're going to fix it.
How Jim Perdue took the reins of the family meat processing business, navigated changing consumer demands, and helped grow Perdue into a $7 billion business.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
A family business can be complicated, especially when it comes to succession. Sometimes there are bitter struggles about who will take over, and sometimes no one wants to take over, which was the case with Perdue Farms. Jim Perdue wasn't that interested in becoming a third-generation head of the family business. He'd been around chicken coops his entire life, and he was interested in striking out on his own and building something totally separate, which he did pursue, as you will hear, so I won't give away what Jim actually decided to do. But as you probably guessed, given his title, Jim Perdue did eventually return to the family business and take over from his legendary dad, Frank. When Jim Perdue became CEO of Perdue Farms in 1991, it was primarily a regional mid-Atlantic fresh poultry processor, a company that sold legs and thighs and breasts to grocery stores. But consumer habits were changing. People started to get wise about natural and organic and antibiotic-free. And those consumer demands would end up driving Jim Perdue's strategy and come to define his legacy as he helped to grow Perdue into a national brand and a $7 billion company. Jim grew up in Salisbury, Maryland, where the family business is still based today. The family home was a block away from headquarters.
In the summer, I would work in hatcheries, and then I started working as a maintenance guy over in the grain area, and I built a grain dryer one summer. I was an electrician, and then I would spell flock advisors. Flock advisors are people who have about 30 farms, and they go ordering feed, checking on the baby chicks, checking on the management of the chickens. And if they go on vacation during the summer, which they did, then you'd have people fill in for a week. So I would go and fill in for a week, screw up the entire system, and they'd come back to a mess, you know. And then I have three sisters, and they all worked in the office. My mother was the payroll clerk. It was really everybody pitched in and was part of the family effort.
But when you were a kid, was Perdue still, did it feel like a pretty small business?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it felt very small. We had 100 people total in the company. Mm. You know, they'd play softball at lunch and in the weekends and that sort of thing. So it was a very, very comfortable family situation.
Wow. I read that, like, really up until the late 60s, like when you went to the grocery store, if you bought chicken, it would just say thighs, breast, you know, drums, whatever. There were no brands. And really, Purdue kind of pioneered this idea that you were buying Purdue chicken.
Well, as you said, all chicken was a commodity in the 60s. But my dad, and it was interesting, we still have his yellow pads where he surveyed butcher shops. And at the time in New York City, he assumed butcher shops were the purveyors. They were the people that were experts in meat. And so he did this 25 questions of, what do you want in a chicken? And they would say, well, I want, you know, accurate weights, good ice coverage, because they came in ice pack. They were covered with ice, you know, no scratches, no bruises, et cetera. So he brought that back. And that's when he started saying, hey, we can differentiate our chickens better than anybody else's. And that was in 1969. And so that was sort of the beginning of differentiating the product from the commodity chicken that was out there.
Did you, I mean, as a kid, was there an expectation, at least in your mind, that you would work for the family business one day? Was that sort of an understood thing?
When I went to college, that was clearly what I was going to do. And I think the expectation was that I would come back from college and go to work in the company, which I did.
Yeah.
And I lasted 10 months and decided that this wasn't for me.
Why is that? Why did you decide that?
Well, I you know, I'm 21 years old.
I think this is like 1973, around then.
That's right, 1973. So, you know, I was didn't have a lot of confidence, as a lot of young people don't have a lot of confidence. And when you're working in a business that has your name on the door, you don't know whether you're getting a pat on the back because you did a good job or it's because, you know. And so the one thing I knew is I had to leave. In the one area I actually majored in biology in college. So I loved the idea of growing fish the way we grow chickens. So aquaculture was my focus. And I went to Massachusetts and got a master's in marine biology and then worked in an oyster hatchery down here for a year. And then I went out to Seattle, Washington and got a PhD in fisheries working with salmon.
Wow.
Which was really my goal, was to get into the salmon business.
So you really like thought, I want to do something on my own. I want to get into something completely different. And you thought you were going to pursue a life of fisheries.
Exactly. Yeah. I didn't leave just to go away for a year. I left for good. In fact, it was 10 years I was gone. as my dad said, the one thing I know is you're overeducated, because he didn't finish college. So this thing about getting a PhD, he couldn't understand why I would do that.
Right. After you got your PhD, because you got your PhD from the University of Washington, if I'm right. And you were working at a fishery in the Seattle area, is that right?
No, I just graduated in 83.
All right.
There was a fateful meeting my dad came out to Seattle and he basically said that he was going to either sell the company if I didn't come back. So that was an undue pressure.
Wow.
And I didn't have any job offers, but except to teach at the School of Fisheries.
Yeah.
And that was I didn't want to teach. That's the one thing I knew I didn't want to do, is teach. And so I decided at that point to come back.
And how did you feel about that? Did you think, you know, I'm ready to come back? Or were you like, well, I guess I better do this?
I had mixed feelings. You know, on the one hand, I really loved the aquaculture business. But, you know, on the other hand, after 10 years, I had developed confidence because I had published papers. My work I'd done was well appreciated by the industry out there. So for me, it wasn't as big a decision. For my wife, it was a big decision because she was working at the Seattle Art Museum. We had three kids out there in Seattle. So it was tougher for her, for sure.
Yeah.
Because the one question she asked me is, how many is there a museum in Salisbury?
Right.
And I said, city of 25,000 people, maybe not, but Baltimore's not far away.
All right, so 1983, you come back to the family business, and I guess you got an entry-level management job?
Yeah, you know, the truth is, if I wanted to be a senior vice president the day I came back, it probably would have been something he would have done. But, you know, I wanted to go back into the plants because I knew the plants are where things were really happening.
Sure, yeah.
These harvest plants have, you know, on the order of 1,500 people. Hmm. So it's a great proving ground to learn to manage. And everything's different every day. You're working with a live animal and things just are never, 2 days are never the same. So I wanted to go work in the plants, and he really appreciated that. And I worked there from 83 until 88, maybe something like that, mm-hmm. and became a plant manager at one of the plants here.
And that's really kind of managing, I guess, supply chains and distribution, because that's where all of the processed chicken is going out to supermarkets.
Correct. And every day we call it the mix. In other words, if you were to sell 100% whole birds, or you sent 100% cut up chicken into drums, thighs, and breast. So every day you would change your mix depending on the market, you know, where the market prices were, for example. And so there was a lot of decisions about what to run each day.
Yeah. You were still, I mean, this is in the mid-80s. I mean, you were still pretty much a regional mid-Atlantic chicken brand, right? I mean, at that time.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we had about 6 plants at the time. So we were probably in the top 10, I would say, in size, in a number of chickens.
Yeah. So I read that, I mean, your dad, Frank, he kind of really made this company into a bigger player. But I read that he was a pretty demanding leader, that his expectations were really high. And did you, like, how would that level of demand kind of show itself with respect to the work that you did?
Well, you know, I hate to say this, but he was probably gentler with me than he was with anybody else.
Hmm.
I think he was afraid, maybe he's afraid he's going to run me off. Because, you know, there's an old story. Dad said he only fired 3 people in his life, but he ran off about 300 people just right. Because he was so hard on them that they couldn't stand the pressure. So, but yeah, he would call out people in a meeting, you know, 20 people sitting around a table, call one person out for poor performance, which, you know, that wasn't my style, but that was his style. And it was the normal style, I think, back then, 70s, 80s, you know. And so we had a group of leaders who really were a group of soldiers. You know, they basically got the orders from the chief, and then they were very, very good at executing those orders.
I wonder when you, I mean, as you kind of rose through the ranks as a leader, did you look at your dad's leadership model, which, as you say, I mean, that's a 1980s model, Jack Welch, you know, some of these legendary figures of the 80s, you know, that was the way to be a leader, to kind of call people out and to be really demanding. But was there a part of you that thought, you know, I'm going to try and create a different leadership model when I become leader, or was that really not on your mind at that point?
You know, it's fascinating, Guy, that it evolved. And we as a company in about 87, 88 or thereabouts hired the consultant Phil Crosby.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a book called Quality is Free, and he had a school down in Florida, and it was called the Quality College. And we sent 1,000 people for a week of training down there. My dad wanted to do that because he had heard from a textile company, Millikan, down in South Carolina, that they had sent all their people there.
Hmm.
But really what they taught us was how to manage people better in a more positive way, recognizing people, for example, which was not done at all here at the time.
Hmm.
And so that had a huge influence on me. It was transformational in this company. It truly was. And what it did is it also changed a lot of people. A lot of faces of those senior people in the company left because they didn't like this idea of recognizing people, for instance.
Mm. That it was like kind of infantilizing or something.
Yeah. You know, Guy, I'll tell you a great story in the plant.
Mm.
We started giving good egg awards. This was a card in the shape of an egg, and you had to catch 5 people doing something right that week. That's how fundamental the change was. And so I remember there was a guy who cleaned his truck outside where the chickens come in before the next shift and for the new guy coming on.
Hmm.
I gave the guy a good egg award. And what he gave him is a free lunch. Well, you know what? they weren't redeeming these. You know what they did with these Good Egg Awards? They took them home and showed them to their family because they were so proud that they got a Good Egg Award. And so then we had to do two. We had to give one for the lunch, and we had to give a certificate to take home to put on the wall.
Right.
And that just told you how powerful this whole idea of recognizing people is. And so it, you see a couple of those kinds of things, and you'll never go back again to an old style of management.
So when you took the reins of the company in 91, tell me, sort of describe the landscape. I mean, you were taking over, I'm assuming, a pretty healthy business. But at that point, did you already have ambitions for what you wanted Purdue to be? Or was it kind of a moment for you to assess and kind of ask questions and get comfortable in the job first?
Well, I'll tell you, Guy, luck has a lot of things going for it. And at the time when we made the change, I became chairman and CEO, and the then president, Don Mabe, retired. And so the president replacing him was a guy named Pelham Lawrence, who was our CFO for 17 years. Pelham was a very enlightened, visionary, strategic thinker. I was not. So the joke is, I'm his boss, but the truth is, I learned more from Pelham about strategic thinking, and he started having strategic planning meetings. And that's also when we had a lot of changeover, because his expectation was that when people have a problem, they solve their problem. They don't come to him with the problem.
And so whereas
with Dad, everybody had to go to Dad when they had a problem, and then he would tell them what to do. That means when Frank Perdue made all the decisions, the risk is only in one place.
Sure.
Nobody, you couldn't fail because it wasn't your decision. But when Pelham said, you know, you got a problem, go back and talk to your people. They'll probably help you with the answer. And when you come up with the answer, come back and tell me what it was. So yet, no, I did not have a game plan when I became CEO. But I embraced the idea of strategic thinking. So we started a lot of things when I came in and Pelham came in. Like, we set our values out on paper. We put our vision down on a piece of paper. And we had state of the business meetings throughout the company to share information. So it was also a very big change and time of change in the business when we transitioned from my dad and Don Mabe to myself and Pelham Lawrence.
And you became the pitch man too. Like, you started to do TV commercials.
Yeah, my dad immediately came to me and said, look, my voice is starting to crack, and so maybe you should start thinking about doing this. So we did about six commercials together, maybe seven, and it was the most fun I think I've ever had, is being on a shoot with my dad. One, for example, was I'm sitting in my office in the commercial, and I'm reading all these complaint letters. And I'm going, you know, I know we get a lot of complaints from consumers, but I don't remember my dad getting this many complaints. And then the next shot is of him at a mailbox, and he's unloading complaints that he's written into the mailbox, you know. And so that was just a lot of fun we had with that transitioning as a spokesperson.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound. And you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I remember when I was a kid, I grew up in California, so you know, Purdue wasn't in California at the time.
Foster Farms,
yeah. And I remember back then, you know, my mom, who was sort of an early adopter, or already in the 80s, was talking about antibiotics, and she would go to Mrs. Gooch's and these stores and find, you know, antibiotic-free chicken. When did that start to become something that really percolated into the mainstream, that you when you started to hear about it from consumers?
I think one of the most interesting meetings I have every month, I don't have now, but the CEO does, but I attend them because I love them, is our consumer call meeting. And what we do is we identify the top complaints of our – we get 3,000 to 4,000 contacts a month from consumers. Most of them complaints, and that's how we learn where we have problems. And I love that. And we actually get on the call. The person on the call is recorded. So we replay the recording of how we screwed up their dinner. And then the plants are on there. And that plant manager has to answer the question about what are you going to do about it? Because we know exactly what plant and what time that product was produced. And so they have to give an update on how they're going to fix it. But also part of those contacts is people asking questions about, do you use antibiotics? Do you use hormones? How are your chickens raised? Do you care about them? You know, what's in your cooked products? What kind of chemicals? You know, so and some things you have to determine whether it's a fad or whether it's a serious issue.
Yeah.
And I say that because back in the 90s, there was a lot of talk about environmental packaging, you know, recycling packaging or packaging that'll deteriorate in a landfill, which styrofoam will not. And it turned out that to be a fad. That wasn't serious at the time. Now, today, it's much more of an issue. Mm. But in 2000, we started getting a lot of people asking about antibiotics in these calls. And it percolated up to the senior management that this is an issue we need to look at. So we started on a project. We called it Wheaties. And we called it Wheaties because at the time, we and everybody else gave prophylactically antibiotics every day in the ration. Thinking that if you control the gut fauna, they'll be more efficient at converting the feed to meat.
Yeah,
that was the theory. It's called growth promoting antibiotics,
right?
And that's the way. So they had a problem with that. So I have always said, and I believe strongly, that a consumer will let us do to our chickens what they do to their kids. So for example, they give with an ear infection, they'll give. They'll give amoxicillin, I think, if I remember the antibiotic. But it's only for 3 days, 4 days, you know, prescribed by a doctor. And then it's gone. They don't give it every morning in their Wheaties. And so we started working on how can we get rid of our antibiotics. And it took us literally 10 to 12 years to do it. And what we found, guys, the thing you always find, it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't grow slower if you don't use antibiotics. It was just one of these, you know... I hate to say it, maybe not be appropriate, but a wives' tale, you know, that somehow enhanced something. The hardest place to do it was in the hatchery where the baby chicks are hatched.
To stop giving antibiotics.
Yes, because when we give – now, vaccines are okay, and consumers have no problem with vaccines. Why? Because they give vaccines to their kids. So we gave two vaccines to chickens in the hatchery, and one of them is given by punching a hole in the egg the last week. Before they hatch, and the embryo absorbs the vaccine. Mm-hmm. And so when you poke a hole in an egg, that's not good because now bacteria can get in that hole. So we would use gentamicin, which is a human antibiotic, in that hole to prevent the chick from getting a bacteria infection. But so what we had to do is we had to clean up our act in the hatchery. We had to clean the eggs, get rid of the bacteria. So we did things like all the vaccines, instead of just mixing them on the floor, they were done in a hood like you did in chemistry class in high school, which is much more hygienic. And then every egg that came from a farm had to be wiped with a baby wipe. And so we were using more baby wipes because we're due 13 million baby chicks a week or eggs a week. And we were wiping every one of them to get bacteria off. So really, I think we were using antibiotics in the hatchery to cover for a dirty system.
Yeah.
And that took us a long time to clean up that part of our business.
But it sounds like really it was a response to consumer demands. I mean, given that you grew up around chickens your whole life, you grew up in an agricultural family, you probably just thought initially, what's the big deal? We've been doing this forever. This is totally safe.
Absolutely. I was a flock advisor at one time, and I could take antibiotics to the farm. Today, a veterinarian has to prescribe on a piece of paper antibiotics and how long it's given and how it's given in the water for 3 days, whatever it is. But back then it was just helter skelter. I mean, there just was not much control whatsoever. And like you say, the one thing my dad taught all of us is you better listen to the consumer. If you don't listen to the consumer, you will die. So you need to listen to everything they have to say, and you better take it to heart. And so that's another reason why we still listen to the consumer here.
But I mean, it sounds like in that case, a consumer kind of saved your butt because you, I'm assuming, like many people in the industry at the time, were maybe a little resistant to this idea.
It took some change, I think, within the company. I think people understood that we needed to do it. And when we made the decision to do it, we actually made an announcement in Washington about no antibiotics. And we became the pariah of the industry because now they knew they were going to have to change.
They have to do the same thing.
Yeah. So Purdue always has had a reputation of being a leader. My dad was hated by a lot of companies because, you know, when he started talking about quality, they had to do the same thing, and they didn't like that. So we like being the leader. In fact, whenever we make a decision and I get a complaint from a competitor, I know we made the right decision. So that's one of my barometers about either that or, for example, a commercial. If we do a commercial and it's hard hitting and I get a lawsuit from Tyson, I go, fantastic. I love it. Bring them on, you know.
Wow. Yeah, I'm curious about how you kind of started to look at the next thing. I think it sounds like you were guided by consumers and consumer reactions and feedback. Because you made a huge leap into natural and organic foods with the purchase of Coleman Natural Foods, I think, in 2011. And that was, I guess, a big change for Purdue, right? Because all of a sudden, you own this natural and organic brand.
That's correct. And then what we found out when we bought Coleman is that these organic chickens were very different. They tasted different. We do a lot of flavor profiles in our innovation center. We have a very sophisticated hedonic system of measuring things. And the meat was more tender. And we were going, how can that be? Why are these organic chickens better? I mean, why do they provide a better eating experience? So we started getting into the details of that. And there's a lot of variables. That's the problem, is controlling the variables. You know, they're less densely grown. They have access to the outside. They're much more active. And so we started measuring activity, believe it or not, with strobe cameras and things. Found out that our chickens just do three things, and most chickens in America. They eat, sleep, and what we call mess around, which means spar with each other or something. And most chickens, it's dark. You can't even see inside the chicken house. The farmer has to wear a headlamp in order to work in the middle of the day because it's a blacked out house. So we decided, you know, we started making all these changes, opening the houses up, putting in windows. We've paid now for about half of our houses to be windowed again so that there's light, natural light in there. About half of our chickens now go outside. Even though they're not organic. All organic chickens have outside access. But we said that's such a good thing. We want all of our chickens to have outside access because, it makes them more active. That messing around measurement is double what it used to be because we think it's healthier for the chicken and it produces a better product, all of these things put together. And for example, on antibiotics, they can't use antibiotics just like we can. We found out that using herbs, rosemary, I can't remember, there's two or three that they were using it in order to help the gut deal with some of these bad bugs, you know, that are in the gut. So it's a tremendous amount of learning once we got into the organic business.
This is the meat processing business, the chicken poultry business is a complicated business because there's a lot of moving parts. Let's just say filled with landmines of things that could go wrong. You have Purdue, like many other chicken processing companies and poultry companies, has been criticized for a number of things. So let me ask you about one of the things that, you know, Purdue got criticized for, which is, I think around 2015, there was a video that came out, an animal welfare group called Mercy for Animals put out a video showing abuse of chickens in some of your facilities.
Yeah, it was a terrible video.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not pleasant at all.
Right. But you actually addressed it head on, right? You said, hey, let's talk about this instead of hide from it. Tell me a little bit about what happened and the thinking behind that decision.
You know, we've had videos prior to then.
Sure.
And our reaction then was the same thing. Those people shouldn't be on our farm. They could bring in bacteria to the farm. This isn't right. And so that was the prevalent thinking. We had one person, actually it was the guy from Coleman, who was on our senior management team. And when we asked the question, how are we going to respond to this? He said, well, did we know this was going on? And we said, well, no, of course not. We would have done something. He said, well, then let's thank them.
Thank the company that exposed the video.
Absolutely. there was sort of a silence in the room. Everybody said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, if they found it, and we have, let's thank them." So we did. We called them and said, "Not only we appreciate what you did, but would you mind coming up to our corporate headquarters? We'd like to talk to you."
You called Mercy for Animals.
Mercy for Animals and Compassion in World Farming and Compassion in Killing, I think were the three. Or no, HSUS, I'm sorry. Yep. HSUS was the third. And so they came up here, and it was a very tense kind of standoff.
First of all, probably a lot of them are vegetarians.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but we had a dialogue, and they told us what they thought, and we told them what we were trying. We felt like we were headed down a road that they might appreciate.
Yeah.
And they did. They said, you know, you need to tell people some of these things you're doing about more space, light, you know, what you're doing for the animals. You know, you need to go out and tell people. And so that evolved into the next year. We had an animal care summit, and we brought in not only those three, but about four others. And so we had, you know, five or six or seven animal care groups around the U.S. Come in here, along with academia that from England about animal welfare. And it was fascinating. And we said, this is what we're going to plan to do in the next 5 years. And they applauded us. And so we've now had our, I think, four animal care summits. And actually, I think it's just a great relationship. And it even evolved, Guy, into the point where the lady from Compassionate World Farming called me one day and said, would you mind coming to England? That's where their corporate headquarters are, and talk at our annual world conference. I said, okay, as long as you say it's safe, I'll come. Because now I'm going to be speaking in front of 500 vegetarians.
Right.
And so the title is, can an animal rights group and a big meat company develop trust? That was the title. And we talked about how it evolved into the point that I do trust her. I believe in what she believes in. The only problem with that whole meeting is every break, there was hummus. That was it. So at the end of the day, my wife and I went out. They do have Five Guys burgers in England, in London. So we went out to a Five Guys and got a burger and said, you know, I'm sorry. But, you know, it even evolved into, you know, she and others said, why don't you make some, you know, vegan items? And so that really is what launched. I credit them with helping us launch our Chicken Plus chicken nuggets, which is it's vegetables and meat in a chicken nugget. So it's been a very fascinating. I tell you guys, certain things in your life that you you go, wow, I'd never thought that I'd be in London, England, talking to the world Compassionate World Farming.
Jim, you know, I'm curious. I mean, full disclosure, I eat meat. I eat lots of chicken, and I aspire not to. And part of that is because, for health reasons, but also for animal welfare reasons, I really do think that one day I won't eat it. And I did an interview about a year ago with Pat Brown, the founder of Impossible Foods. And he believes that that we can produce meat from plant sources, and that that is where we will be headed towards as a species. Now, meat consumption is up, right? More people living middle-class lives in Asia and Africa are eating more meat. So there's no question that meat consumption around the world is up. But it's also, and you know this, you know, livestock production particularly is really bad for the environment over time. And I wonder, when you think about the future, I know that you're producing, you know, sort of these hybrid chicken nuggets with a little bit of meat animal protein and some vegetable proteins, but I don't know. I mean, what do you make of this idea that in the future you could still produce meat that tastes and looks like meat, but from plant-based sources?
If that's what the consumer wants, we will provide it. We are not, you know, our vision is to be the most trusted name in food and agricultural products. So trusted is the key word for us in our vision. So I trust the consumer. And if they say that's what you need to do, then we'll do that. You know, Guy, I will say that the number of chickens that we harvest each week has not changed over the last 5 years. So it's not like we're trying to grow more and more chickens. Mm-hmm. What we are growing is more beef, more pork with Nyman Ranch.
Yep.
And they're teaching us at Nyman, for example, this whole thing about rotational agriculture, you know, where their pig field becomes the cornfield next year, mm-hmm. and the pig field is in the old cornfield, and they are rotating this, and so this is also a concept in agriculture that relates a little bit to your point about what's good environmentally and not good environmentally. So I think there's a lot of room out here to do both, you know, to produce protein, but also to do it more environmentally friendly. And of course, chicken is more environmentally friendly than say beef,
yeah.
just from the statistics. But still, it doesn't mean there can't be important things done.
Yeah. Jim, the most delicious chicken I ever ate in my life, I remember it, came from a very, very small farm in Virginia called Ayrshire Farms, run by a woman named Sandy Lerner. She actually is a founder of Sysco and runs a small little farm where she raises heritage breed chickens and sells them in a shop there. And I roasted it with some salt, and it was incredible. It was the most amazing. But it speaks to this idea that you can't actually do that at scale. You can't produce that level of quality at scale, or can you? What do you think?
Oh, I think you can. And, you know, our newest endeavor is growing chickens in pasture.
Under the Purdue brand, or is it a different brand?
Now, see, I can't tell you all the secrets,
you. Okay.
Guy.
Okay.
You know, but I can tell you this. At one of these animal care summits, we had a guy from Canada, a professor up there, talking about omega-6s and omega-3s, mm-hmm. and how you influence the omega-6s and omega-3s with what the chicken is eating. And so we acquired a company here this past year that is a pasture company. And I think what we're finding is that we have a chicken that will compete with her very well. They definitely taste different, okay? But I think when you add to that, it's kind of like, you know, the lady from Compassionate World Farming said, you know, these are the way we like to raise, see you raise chickens, is pasture, this sort of thing. But your job is to figure out how to do it economically. And she's exactly right. And that's what we're working hard on right now.
Yeah. Right now, we are in the middle of the greatest global health and economic crisis, probably in living memory for anyone, right? And it's been particularly hard with respect to the meat and poultry industry, right? I mean, there have been meatpacking plants where people have gotten sick, and this is a challenging time, right? Because consumers are still demanding these products. I mean, I'm still buying chicken, right? So how do you do that safely? How do you make sure that the people who are processing our chicken are safe?
Yeah, you know, there's an old adage, you've seen everything at my age.
Yeah, yeah.
I never saw this coming, that's for sure. And I'll tell you, it was a journey of learning. And every day we would learn something new, either from the CDC or from our own experience. I mean, we had operations, our biggest operation had less than, I think, 20, you know, positives. And yet we had operations with 300 or 400. And of course, we're somewhat lucky because most of them are very rural areas. But even contact tracing, the last few weeks, you know, when we had some positives, we started using that. And it really was amazing. We had an operation in Tennessee that there were 40 people that lived within two blocks of each other near that operation. And we found, and by contact tracing, they discovered that most of their positives were coming out of that area. So we called all 40 associates and said, please stay home. We will pay you for 2 weeks to stay home. And it solved the problem. We put in the temperature guns as fast as we could in very early March. And then we have wellness centers at every facility where a worker can come off the line, see a doctor in the community in our wellness center right there, and then go back to work, and they don't lose any time. Those wellness centers became very valuable during this COVID-19 because the nurses and in that center would not only screen people, but they would act every day by calling and contact tracing. And we actually felt like our folks were safer in that environment, you know, once we had all the plexiglass up, workstations, you know, taking doors off hinges so nobody touches a doorknob. Mm-hmm. But where we found it was a bigger issue is when they left, they either, if they commuted, In other words, a lot of people in a car, that was a problem. How they live in their house, you know, if there's multiple families, that turned out to be a big issue. And so that's where we needed help from the social services of the state. And we encouraged them to go out and help communicate, you know, how you live in a situation where you're trying to prevent the spread. Because they're the most important. They are the most important. We put people at the number one goal in our company. They and our truck drivers, you know, all of those unsung heroes is really what they are.
Well, Jim, when you think about your leadership journey, do you think that you had some of those skills and abilities from the beginning, from the time that, you know, from your childhood, or do you think that you really actually learned how to become a leader?
That's a very good question. You know, I mean, there's a lot of ways where I did learn to become a leader. Like I said, when I did that transition, you know, I was so lucky to go through that quality college and the change in this company's style of management, you know, between my dad and myself, because we're very different people. I could never manage the way he managed. You know, and for example, he worked 18 hours a day. He would come home, have dinner, and he'd be back in the office till 3 a.m. And so we weren't very close because of that. And that had an indelible impression on me. So when I was raising my kids, I said, weekends are mine. Don't even come near me. So I coached soccer, for example, for all the kids and spent a lot of time with them. And I think it was partly because that was something that I know was missing. And it resulted in a bad marriage between my mother and he, which it often does. So that was, I think you transition. But you have to be true to your own style. You know, people see through that immediately. You know, if you're trying to be somebody you're not genuine, you're not real. You know, for example, I'm probably more like my grandfather than I am like my father. So I, you know, when I was assuming leadership as a CEO, saw a lot of people say, were they big shoes to fill? I said, well, I didn't try to get into them, you know, so.
That's Jim Perdue of Perdue Farms. By the way, remember when Jim moved his family from Seattle to Salisbury, Maryland? Well, Jan, Jim's wife, did end up finding meaningful projects through the arts education program at the Walters Art Gallery in Baltimore. She also became a pretty accomplished watercolorist. Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. The music for this episode was composed and performed by Drop Electric. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Wisdom from the Top from Luminary and Built It Productions.